Strange studies of strange stories.
Andrew waited patiently while the receptionist disappeared into the inner office. He might have used the holographic chatterbox, but unquestionably it was unmanned, or perhaps unroboted, by having to deal with another robot rather than with a human being. Andrew passed the time revolving the matter in his mind. Could unroboted be used as an analog of unmanned, or had unmanned become a metaphoric term sufficiently divorced from its original, literal meaning to be applied to robots? Or to women, for that matter? Such problems came frequently as he worked on his book on robots. The trick of thinking out sentences to express all complexities had undoubtedly increased his vocabulary. Occasionally, someone came into the room to stare at him, and he did not try to avoid the glance. He looked at each calmly, and each in turn looked away.
That robot, Mad Dog, in the office, folks, is named Andrew Martin, and that reading is from the 12th chapter of Isaac Asimov's The Bicentennial Man. This is Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're here exclusively on Patreon, talking robots, talking monsters, talking robot monsters.
Our reader is James Holloway, host of the Monster Man podcast and RPG writer. He's got some cool stuff over on his site, jamesholloway.itch.io, which includes something I've got, the Pamphlet of Pantheons, which is great, and also Wanted Belladonna, Mort Safe, which is for the Troika role-playing game.
So back into Bicentennial Man, I will try to maintain some robotic focus in this episode. Was a little all over the place last time. What's going on so far?
So this robot, Andrew Martin, wants an operation, but we're not sure what kind of operation he wants. But we've gone back in time 200 years to his creation and his adopted family slash owners, the Martins. Over time, Andrew has developed a personality, creativity, and wants which is unlike any other robot. He's got a bank account, and he's been made a free being by law. Now, just recently, because he was attacked in a way, they have made laws to protect him from harm.
You know, we had a Roomba for a while, the robot vacuum cleaner.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure robot is the right word for that, because it's kind of a more sophisticated remote control car. But just that small amount of automation in there changed our relationship to it. You know, Heather always says she's wistful about the Roomba. You know, we got to get another one of those. It really kept things clean. And I totally disagree, because the amount of setup you had to do to get the thing working properly, I started to feel like the Roomba was taking a lot of credit for my work. You know, like you have to move everything out of the way. There was a lot of pre-cleaning that I would never have to do with a normal manned vacuum cleaner. But one day I had left the front door open while it was running, and I realized I couldn't hear it anymore. I looked outside, and the Roomba was like halfway down the driveway, almost to the street. Like it was trying to escape. Now, I know it just thought, you know, well, I'm using the word thought, which is not what it was doing. It was just operating outside, was just another room. It went through a doorway and it didn't know where it was. But it did change my relationship with the room, because I felt bad for it a little, like it wanted to leave.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just trying to go get a human body. Who knows? Let's get into chapter 12.
Now we're at the law offices of Paul. He is the great grandson of Andrew's original owner. Andrew has been made to wait, and he likes to wear clothing, even though he's a metallic robot, a la C-3PO.
Imagine him like C-3PO in a suit.
The Andrew at the beginning of the story looks human, so there must be some changes that happened in the future at this point, from this point. Now, when Paul comes out of his office, he's wearing heavy makeup, which is the fashion at the time for both men and women. But Andrew, he doesn't like the new fashions, and he's dressed out of date.
Paul had taken to wearing the heavy makeup that fashion was dictating for both sexes, and though it made sharper and firmer the somewhat bland lines of his face, Andrew disapproved. He found that disapproving of human beings, as long as he did not express it verbally, did not make him very uneasy. He could even write the disapproval. He was sure it had not always been so. Oh, man. So this is something that preoccupies me a lot, because we're aging. Yeah. Growing up, a lot of my friends were sort of punk rock, nonconformist types, and it's just odd to watch them slowly change into more conservative, you know, kids these days types. It's something that I think every generation goes through. I've even recently seen a friend online who, you know, never would have been found without her Sex Pistols jacket. And I just saw her writing, you know, rest in peace to the queen. Like, what? I try hard not to be one of these people who's like laughing at a young person for not knowing what a rotary phone is. But I have to admit, it is hard. Like, your biology's almost pushing you that way. And this part, I mean, this robot's getting a little J.K. Rowling, you know, because it's heavier than not liking the new fashions. The word is disapproval,
yeah,
which means there's some sort of moral standard or something? Yeah, like,
I think it's wrong.
Did his sense of identity or fashion sense arrest when he became free? I mean, it's just odd. He really is displaying the characteristics of a person. And this was one of the most fascinating parts of the story. The idea that a robot would be like, only women wore makeup in my day. Mm-hmm. You'd think the robot would go, oh, everybody used to wear makeup, say, in the 1700s. So this is just a trend coming back around. But
yeah,
what a cool part to the story. It's just one sentence.
That's what the story, I think, ultimately is about. Change and how, if you're going to be a part of the world, that changing is being part of that world. Now, Paul asks him about the book that he's writing on the history of robots, and he replies that he's almost finished. But Andrew is there to ask Paul to go to the company that made him and ask for a meeting. Now, the company isn't keen on Andrew, as they see him as not only a kind of failure, but somebody who is progressing robot rights, which could, of course, hurt their bottom line.
Paul is able to get Andrew a meeting with Harley Smythe Robertson, a descendant of the original founder of this robot corporation. He's able to do this because of a lot. You know, he says if the meeting doesn't happen, then Andrew's going to be starting a campaign to strengthen robot rights even further, which he's not planning on doing.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew's not able to lie himself, but he gets Paul to do it on his behalf. So
yes.
Clearly he learned something in that interaction from last time where he was made to threaten violence against those goons who were going to take him apart. He was like, well, I wasn't really going to hurt them. And you know, George said, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
As long as you implied that, it's good enough. I mean, but having somebody lie for you doesn't make it any less of a lie.
Yeah.
You know, if you're hungover and your partner calls in sick for you at work, you're still being deceptive even though somebody else did it. Again, we're seeing this elasticity happen.
And that's something that the laws of robotics don't cover, is lying, because robots can lie, you know, if especially if it interferes with the laws of robotics. So if somebody's life is in danger, and if you tell the truth that will endanger somebody, then they would lie to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as those don't directly interfere with those three laws, then a robot could conceivably lie about a bunch of things and imply things, imply violence, imply threat, even though there is actually no threat that's going on.
Right. Well, I think that that's to the point, your point about the changeable nature of things and how this is about change. You would think it's about a futuristic point of view or how robots might impact our society. But here we are thinking about laws and how they can be interpreted, which is as old as Hammurabi. So that's why it's such an interesting text.
Now, Harley explains that robots are no longer built to be flexible or adaptable for fear of them demanding more freedom. Andrew is the oldest robot and will always be the oldest robot because robots now only last 25 years. Robots are no longer sold to people, they're on leases.
It's that subscription model we were talking about in the last episode.
Andrew explains that the reason for his visit, he wants a new body, an android body that appears human. And Andrew says that his brain will stay as it is, just installed into a new body. And Harley explains that androids never really caught on, so they were discontinued. They don't really do androids.
They, quote, weren't accepted because they looked too human. That's as much as is said about it, but it continues that uncanny valley thing we were talking about in the last episode. Is it that it put people off, or is it just a primal fear of being replaced? Like if we had a servant robot in the house looking like Ewan McGregor or something, I might accidentally leave the door open. Wow, where did that robot go? Oh, Robo Ewan's out on the driveway. Well, I guess he's gone now.
Poor Robo Ewan. Andrew points out that they still have the technology to make androids, but Harley doesn't want to help. Paul points out that by not helping Andrew blend in more, he's putting him at risk. Also, the company replaces robots every 25 years, so they're breaking their own policy by not changing out his body. And he argues that the brain is the person, not the body. So how does that argument set with you?
I don't know if Andrew even believes any of these things. He's just exploiting loopholes to get what he wants. But is the brain the owner of your body? Sure. Yeah, it sits fine with me. I mean, I've been fairly lucky most of my life to keep my original parts, but we were talking yesterday. I've just gotten glasses. Most people have dealt with this most of their lives, but it's tough for me to now I have this non-human part of me I got to keep track of and able to do my basic stuff. And I think that's probably just the beginning of my cyber evolution. Most of my siblings have replacement knees and joints of various kinds, you know, but you don't wear the same pair of shoes your whole life. You constantly got to be switching out the hardware. So
it's so true.
Yeah. And it's your brain that does that. That's the only thing you don't switch out. It's up there in the skull, and the minute that's gone, it's all gone. So, you know, the argument holds water, I guess.
Paul goes on to say if they don't help Andrew, he will be forced to sue, and he could sue forever since Andrew's immortal. He's never going to die. Harley calls this blackmail, but Paul says it's just what's going to happen, and it's all within the law. He's not threatening anything illegal. He's just saying, look, this is what we're going to do if you don't help us. So Paul also says, if anything happens to this brain during the transfer, we will never rest until the corporation is buried, legally speaking.
Yeah, they got to threaten a little bit in case they're like, oops, we killed Andrew. Sorry.
Yeah. So Andrew actually has a bit of a hard time with this, as he's making someone do something that they don't actually want to do. It says, Andrew hesitated a full minute. It amounted to the approval of lying, of blackmail, of the badgering and humiliation of a human being, but not physical harm, he told himself. Not physical harm. He managed at last to come out with a rather faint yes. And of course, harm is the first law of robotics. So he's not, again, breaking the rule of physical harm to a human.
Yeah, well, he's making sure the definition fits what he wants to do. You know, it's sort of Robo Clinton. I did not have sex with that woman. I do think an explicit comparison is made at some point. I couldn't find it. I think you pointed it out later. But the thing that's living as long as Andrew, the only thing that's living as long as him is these corporations, the law firm and U.S. Robotics. They're almost their own life forms. Another way, this was really interesting perspective on things. And the argument that he just made was very Dracula-like. You know, I can fight you over decades with oodles of resources. I think Dracula says that, you know, in the novel. Mm-hmm. It's the exact advantage that large companies have over regular individuals, though.
The
fact that they have the resources to bury you with legal stuff. But this comparison to corporations, I think, also softens the sad ending to the story a little bit.
It takes Andrew months to adapt to his new form. He looks very close to human, but he still isn't quite. His features are a bit stiff, but he can now wear clothes and most people won't notice that he's not human. And this body is also organic, stronger than normal human, but still flesh and blood. So we're getting into some kind of replicant territory a la Blade Runner here.
Paul's worried that the operation didn't work because it's taking him so much time to get used to this body. But I think just like a human after an operation, he sort of needs to relearn how to use his stuff.
Yeah. So Andrew tells Paul that he wants to get into robobiology, a new field that incorporates machine and flesh together. Andrew builds a lab in his house and it has an extended library.
He doesn't want to continue to be an artist or historian. I live too long for any one career to seize me by the throat and never let me go, he says. And I think that's probably true even in our short human lives, that what you care about shifts kind of unbelievably in a way. Like my relationship with movies, for example, totally different than it used to be.
Right. Yeah.
I used to care so deeply what was playing at the cinema on the weekends. And
yeah.
And I just don't, you know, it's like I just, my cares have shifted. I don't care as much. I still like that stuff, but I could definitely get into robobiology now, I think.
Yes. Yeah, that's strange that you bring that up because I used to go to movies almost weekly when I was in Los Angeles and get excited about new movies coming out. And
I'd read the release schedule. I wanted to know everything.
But now, I don't care.
It seemed very important. And it seems now very it seems like the opposite important. Of that.
Now, years go by, and Paul tells Andrew that the corporation that made him is changing the entire way they build robots. They are now using central brains that control dozens of robots. Andrew points out that eventually they'll probably just have one big brain to control all of the robots. And Andrew thinks that this is dangerous for them to put all their eggs in one basket. And I think the Star Wars Trade Federation would agree with him on this.
It's one of those, we talked about this last time, but it is one of those tropes we always laugh at. Yet it is a totally plausible explanation for why that might happen organically. I can't believe it. This is partly Andrew's doing, actually. The fact that he's become free and that the corporation that created him can't control him is really what spurred them to limit all robots.
Oh man, it's really freaking me out that Asimov is arguing for George Lucas beyond the grave.
And winning the argument.
Yeah.
Because why wouldn't they do that eventually if all of those robots were independently brained? Maybe they'll start joining the rebellion. You don't know what they're going to do.
Now, Paul says that he'll be dead by the time this one big giant brain controls all the robots thing. And Andrew doesn't like him talking like that, you know, talking about his death. But Paul points out that he's mortal and will die. He doesn't have any children, so all of his money that he has is going to go to Andrew when he dies. Andrew doesn't like that at all and wants to argue with him about it, but Paul just changes the subject to Andrew's new project.
Which is?
Making it so that he, as an android, can eat food and gain sustenance from it. Paul says your battery is more efficient than that.
I was reading it and I just went, Andrew, why? I love food, don't get me wrong. Love it. But the daily dealing with it, I mean, can we swap for a while? I'll try out an atomic cell for a few weeks to not have to decide what to make. And then, you know, let's compare our experiences.
Now, Andrew doesn't finish the project until after Paul dies. The great-grandson of his original owner is now dead. And this causes Andrew to feel alone and vulnerable in the world. It says, If a man had died, the firm of Feingold and Charney lived. For a corporation does not die any more than a robot does. The firm had its directions and it followed them soullessly. By way of the trust and through the law firm, Andrew continued to be wealthy. And in return for their own large annual retainer, Feingold and Charney involved themselves in legal aspects of the new combustion chamber, which is his stomach thing, is what they're talking about here.
Yeah.
And again, this is, corporations are scary.
That was the passage I was looking for, yeah.
It's strange to me to think about things like, well, Disney. You know, all that stuff was supposed to be in the public domain because it's gone over that time period. However, because the Disney Corporation is powerful, they've gotten people to rewrite the laws so they can still hold on to all that stuff and control it.
Corporations go on and on. Disney's dead. The person that had that name.
Yeah.
But the company goes on, and not only do they go on, they merge with each other, Voltron-like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and speaking of Disney, I feel like someday the movies aren't even going to be called the movies anymore. They're going to be called the Disneys. Because it's just going to, they're going to own all of them.
Well, yeah, at the rate they're going, it's pretty crazy.
It's sort of like rich family, you know, the beer families back in, you know, pre-prohibition, when beer became a huge industry, lager in the United States, those families immediately started marrying with one another. The Pabsts and the Bushes and the Lemps, they started marrying up. It's just something that happens. But those were people in their families that own these companies. And it's like, even in the absence of the people that these companies are named for, the companies still marry up with one another, just the way that royals try to do, or, you know, just like they try and do on Game of Thrones or something like that. They do it on their own. And so it's, man, it's
consolidating
creepy.
Power.
Yeah.
But times change. The Robocorp ends up in space doing its manufacturing, and Earth becomes park-like with its stabilized 1 billion population, with an almost equal robot population as well.
Which is really interesting. You know, all the industrial stuff moving off planet is obviously very interesting, so the Earth can be renewed, made more natural, park-like, as you said, which seems like a comment maybe on pollution and global warming and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But are there massive world wars in Asimov's other stories that aren't mentioned here, or colonization or something? Because even in 1976, when this story came out, you know, the population was 4 billion people around about. So what happened to the other 3 billion?
Well, they just probably died and weren't reproducing as much.
Yeah.
One of the things that they talk about population growth is that the increase of population growth is slowing down. And it seems like that humanity is going to hit about 10 billion, and then that's it. It's going to start, then it will start retracting.
Oh.
And it'll be a smaller population. People won't be having as many children anymore.
Yeah.
And you can see that in a lot of the Western countries, and Japan as well. You know, they're having population problems because nobody's having kids.
Right.
Because it's just not economically viable to have children. These agrarian civilizations that we've had, you know, where they need big families to work the farms, they're going away. Technology's doing that. So people having more kids is a liability. It costs you more money. So people are having less children, especially with birth control. So yeah, maybe it will eventually come back down to a billion after a time.
It does feel like it would get unsustainable at some point. You know, I think something folks don't often consider when they're talking about these kids these days things is that it was 4 billion in 1976. It's like 8 billion or close to 8 billion people in the world now. So it's almost doubled in our lifetimes. And that has to be affecting us in all sorts of ways we don't even perceive. There's actually a great science fiction story by J.G. Ballard called Millennium that grapples with overpopulation. I put it on the list for the show at some point, and I actually already read it, but I kind of kicked it down the road a little because I'm claustrophobic, and it was really triggering those parts of my brain. The main character has a little apartment that's part of a stairwell in a building, and we'll get to it eventually and talk more about this population stuff because it is actually really fascinating to me. That, again, it's just a little one throw-off sentence in this story, but it made me spin out and think about all kinds of things.
There's so much of the story that does that. Now, the new director of research at the Robocorporation is called Alvin Magduska. Andrew brings his eating system designs to Alvin, and Alvin is very impressed, but he says this process is very dangerous, and Andrew should just stay as he is, because if he tries to incorporate it and it doesn't work, he could be destroyed. Andrew points out that these artificial organs can be used in human bodies, and if the corporation helps Andrew, he will give them the rights to manufacture them and sell them to humans. I mean, this is going to change medicine for humans on a global scale.
Yeah.
So this totally shocks Alvin, and he's stunned, and he's like, well, you know, I got to talk to my superiors about this because this is above my pay grade. But of course, they go for it.
The tendency to lengthen human life by prosthetic devices has already been remarked on, Andrew says, as part of his argument. Even just using our smartphones, I think, is a leap toward becoming cyborgs, right? There are things I don't remember anymore because I don't need to. Mm-hmm. And even apart from body changes, that's just a remarkable change in the way we use our brains. There's a real thin line between robot and human even now. You know, we're all trending towards Darth Vaderism.
What?
More machine than man.
Well, yeah, I don't know about more, but definitely a lot more machine. You know, there's people like you were talking about. My dad's got a chip, his Parkinson's. He's got the chip in his brain. He's a full-on cyborg.
He's got a cape that he wears around, too, and a little, like, panel on his chest, right?
I think you're thinking of Darth Vader.
Steve Vader. I didn't know he had a chip, though.
Oh, yeah, he's got a chip for his Parkinson's. It's helped out considerably. It controls his brain chemistry so that he doesn't have the seizures.
And,
he still takes medication, but not as much as he would have to, because he's had it for a long time now, and it's progressed very slowly. So we've had him around, thankfully.
Yeah.
Now, the operation for Andrew is a success. Andrew can eat only certain things, but Andrew has ideas for more modifications, making it so he can have more types of food. But he'll have to design an anus. He's going, well, if I'm doing that, what about genitals? And that, I was like, well, he doesn't have genitals already? I thought that would have been an early thing that he would have got in there, you know?
Nah, I assumed he was smooth like a Ken doll. But, you know, because if he's not a sex bot, why would they have ever done that?
Well, for him, when he asked for his human-like body, I would think he would like want a penis because he's identifying as male or some other kind of sex organ so that he can have those kinds of relationships with people. But I guess he's just not interested in it. So why would he have a sex organ?
And probably everybody at the Robo Corporation was just slightly embarrassed. You know, nobody wanted to be on that team, just like he's going to be all on his own on this anus design project.
Oh, yeah.
But it says, yeah, he's got to just kind of sip on olive oil at first because he doesn't have an organic excretory system. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, how is he getting, even with the olive oil, there's got to be some kind of waste product. Does he have like a spit valve somewhere, like a trumpet or a little chimney? How's he doing this now?
Yeah, they don't go into details on it, but I'd like to think, yeah, he's the spit valve. Alvin says, it seems like you're just trying to make yourself a human being, which is nuts. You're better than a human, and any further modification will risk you, so why are you doing it? But Andrew, he doesn't answer. Well, after all of his prosthetics and artificial organs are a huge boon to humanity, Andrew gets lots of recognition and respect. Because part of his deal was that everybody knew that he was the one that designed all this stuff that's helping all these people live and have extended lives and everything like that. But people don't call it robobiology, they call it prosthetology.
The interest, language and the way language is used is threaded throughout this. We call it something different now. It's human-based if it's prosthetology. It doesn't seem so alien.
In his 150th year, the corporation throws a big party in his honor. And it says, if Andrew saw the irony in this, he kept it to himself. Because obviously the corporation hated him for 100 years and thought he was the worst. And now he's making them all this money.
Just like the Sex Pistols jacket turns into reverence for the Queen. What?
So in the decades that follow, Andrew goes off Earth and to the moon, which has become more Earth-like than Earth, it says. He's designing prosthetics for working in lower gravity. He stays there for about 10 years, but then comes back to Earth to the offices of Feingold and Charney, now run by a guy called Simon DeLong. Andrew is bothered that he's not recognized as human. Everyone treats him as human. He actually ran a lab on the moon and he gave orders to humans and they obeyed him.
Yeah, robo boss. How about that? But just like he wanted to be called free, even if nothing else changed in his life, he now wants to be called human, even though nothing really is going to change physically about him.
Yeah.
Again, it's language. It's the names of things.
And Simon says, well, you are human by, you know, de facto. People treat you like a human, so you're human, so don't worry about it. But that's not enough for Andrew. Simon says, look, if this goes to court, it will be a big mistake because you are not human. Andrew says, I have the shape of a human being and organs equivalent to those of a human being. My organs, in fact, are identical to some of those in a prosthetized human being. I have contributed artistically, literarily, and scientifically to human culture as much as any human being now alive. What more can one ask? And Simon says, look, you'll have to go to the world legislature and they won't do it. Andrew orders him to do it, to go to the legislature about it without even thinking about it. He's ordering a human around. And Simon says, look, I'll try and arrange a meeting.
Roboss. I shouldn't have said Roboboss. Roboss is much more.
Roboss.
Yeah, he's
better.
The Roboss.
So the chairman of the Science and Technology Committee is a woman named Chi Lee Sing. She says that she understands his position, but she also believes that there not going to grant him his human status. They just won't have the votes for it. She says that there's still an element of suspicion towards robots, despite everything Andrew has done for humanity. They fear setting a precedent. But Andrew argues, what precedent? I'm the only robot like me. Like, there's no other robot, and there never will be any robots like me. And she tells them, well, there are no robots like you yet,
right?
But forever's a long time. And people are worried about that. She apologizes, and she said she's going to support him as best she can, but she knows that they won't get enough votes. She says if this pushes public opinion the other way, then there might even be a demand for his dismantling, because people will see it as a threat. Even with all the technology he shared, people might even start to see him as trying to make people into robots themselves with his prosthetic organs and things.
Yeah.
So Andrew feels that he has nothing to lose and says he wants to fight for his humanity. And Lee Sing says she will support him as long as it's not politically damaging for her. And Andrew accepts that. Andrew and the law firm decide to play the long game with this, and they set up a campaign they intend to lose.
Yeah, it's so smart the way they attack it. They instituted a lawsuit denying the obligation to pay debts to an individual with a prosthetic heart on the grounds that the possession of a robotic organ removed humanity, and with it, the constitutional rights of human beings. Very clever.
So they want it to go to world court, and to get it to the world court, though, it takes years and millions of dollars worth of litigation. But they get there and they lose, which is what they wanted. That helps.
First of all, we have established the fact that no number of artifacts in the human body causes it to cease being a human body. Secondly, we have engaged public opinion in the question in such a way as to put it fiercely on the side of a broad interpretation of humanity, since there is not a human being in existence who does not hope for prosthetics if that will keep him alive. Mm-hmm. So they've pushed it in a direction where humans are really afraid of being called robots. It's so smart. This is where the fear of becoming Darth Vader really helps.
But Simon is still not optimistic because the one organ that matters, the brain, is still not human. He tells Andrew not to give up hope. They'll be shaking palms and kissing babies and shoring up support for him. Now, Congresswoman Lee Sing is much older at this point in the story, and Andrew points out that once she said she would abandon him if it threatened her career, but now she puts her whole career and her reputation on the line, and she says, one can change one's mind, you know. Somehow, abandoning you became a higher price than I cared to pay for just one more term. As it is, I've been in the legislature for over a quarter of a century. It's enough.
And this is what you wish all politicians would do.
Oh, God,
stop worrying about being reelected and go for things. Not necessarily campaigning to make robots human, but whatever the issue may be.
Sure,
Although, and I think it's clever how that is a little microcosm of the theme that we're going to conclude on as well, that, that things just kind of have to have an end for them to have value.
Now, Andrew ponders trying to change his brain into a human brain, but Lee Sing says, that's not it. It would still be man-made brain. You're still going to be a robot. That isn't going to change. That's not changing anything. No, there's something that she can't put her finger on that drives this distrust. And then Andrew gets it. It clicks. So now we're back at the very beginning of the story. He's here for this surgery.
It's back to chapter one. It even says chapter one reprise to let us know we're at the beginning. We didn't know exactly what procedure he was coming to see the surgeon about, and now we're going to figure that out.
So the complex surgery that can only be done by a robot but will still harm him, so that's important, breaking the first law. But since he's not human, the robot can proceed. Some time passes, and Lee Sing says that she can't delay the vote any longer, and they're going to lose because there's not enough still. But Andrew says that he's taken a gamble. He's told no one what he was going to do because they would have stopped him. He knows what it is that makes people distrustful of him. He's immortal. And the only way to fix that is to become mortal, as in he has to die at some point. The surgery had set in motion a degradation of his neural pathways that will kill him over time.
Lee Sing says, that's impossible. You broke the third law of self-preservation. And he says, well, I've chosen between the death of my body and the death of my aspirations and desires. To let my body live at the cost of the greater death is what would have violated the third law. So here we are with an interpretation of these laws in order to make what he wants to have happen.
Pretty loose, in my opinion, but
I think so too, because who determines which of those is a greater death? He kind of just made that up out of thin air. Genius.
She begs him to change back, but he says, nope, it can't be undone. He has maybe a year more or less to live left. And she asks, how can this be worth it? And he says, if it brings me humanity, then it will be worth it. If it doesn't, it will bring an end to striving, and that will be worth it too. Well, this move worked. The Congress votes for it. They declare him a human on the eve of his 200th year. There's a big celebration, and he's brought out in a wheelchair because his condition is deteriorated so much by that point. And he is declared a human by the world president. I think we'll have James read this, the final chapter. It's not very long.
Andrew's thoughts were slowly fading as he lay in bed. Desperately, he seized at them. Man, he was a man. He wanted that to be his last thought. He wanted to dissolve, die, with that. He opened his eyes one more time and for one last time recognized Lee Sing waiting solemnly. There were others, but those were only shadows, unrecognizable shadows. Only Lee Sing stood out against the deepening gray. Slowly, inchingly, he held out his hand to her and very dimly and faintly felt her take it. She was fading in his eyes as the last of his thoughts trickled away. But before she faded completely, one last fugitive thought came to him and rested for a moment on his mind before everything stopped. "Little miss," he whispered, too low to be heard.
Yeah, man, that got me. What do you make of that ending, that it wasn't being a man that was his last thought, it was little miss?
Yeah, the things that he cared about, the person that he cared about, what was important to him. And I think that's, you know, what everybody lives for. They live for those things that are important, those people that are important, and those relationships that you have. And a lot of times the ideals of, his ideal was becoming human. That was what was important to him. That was something that he strove for. Whereas maybe people will strive for, you know, rights for individuals, making society more fair. Some people strive just to make more money, to become more rich and more powerful. I think, again, I was saying this at the beginning, the theme of this whole story is change, and everything must change. And if it doesn't change, if he lived for another 300, 400 years, that he won't fit in the world, because the world is constantly changing and you have to change with the world, or just eventually not be a part of it. I mean, looking at the distant future, there's not going to be people anymore. We're going to cease to be human beings and, you know, I don't know how long, maybe 1,000 years with technology. Who knows what we're going to become?
A bunch of Darth Vaders
or something else entirely that we don't even understand.
Bunch of makeup wearing Darth Vaders. That's what it's going to be. But those are the, you know, him having the disapproval of that and still wearing old clothes. And this thing in the end where he's like, I wouldn't have to strive anymore. It's not the central focus of his campaign to die, but that means he's tired. He's tired of struggling.
Yeah.
This woman, Lee Sing, who gave up her career essentially to help him, it seems like he's treasuring her in the end, but no, he thinks back and it's little miss who's been dead for well over a century.
Yeah.
It just makes you think, yeah, you know, I'm still preoccupied with people who are gone, for example, from my youth.
Sure.
And you can't really replace them. No. You know, you meet other people who are like them, perhaps. And that spun me back to what Tolkien's notion was, that brief lives given to men was a gift. Mm-hmm. Because it's part of that change that you're talking about. You can't just replace 90% of yourself. It's all got to go at some point. Mm. That goes to the points in the story about corporations sort of being these old vampires too. You know, some point they need to be torpedoed. It's very wise that the politician here says, well, you may be the only of your kind now, but how can we know that there's probably going to be some disruption where independent people will get access to this corporate technology and there will be more of you. We have to think about that. Things are going to change.
Well, it gets me thinking about this whole idea too, that we're not just us in our heads. We are part of where we come from. We're part of the people that we're with. And as you live a long time, those places change and you lose them. People die and you lose them. And you're going to keep losing things throughout the course of your life. I know it sounds very dark, but I'm going to try and bring it up at the end. that you keep losing lots and lots of things. And those things made you who you are, and you don't have those things anymore. So they're not there. There'll be new things that are shaping you in different ways.
Yeah.
Like when you have children, when anybody has children, those children will shape them in ways that they didn't anticipate as well. Mm-hmm. But then they'll go on and they'll move away. You won't have those things anymore. And I think that there, maybe when you get older, there's so much loss that happens over the course of your life that the world isn't what it was and what you were used to, that you're maybe ready to go at some point. And I think this character was like, you know what? I just want my little miss back, but she's not going to be back. I've had these other people in my life, but they never compared to that one special thing, that one special relationship that I had. It's okay to like kind of let that go and go on your way to die and let the world change.
Yeah.
That's just the natural order of things. It's something I have a really hard time dealing with, you know, with people. I think everybody does. When I think about, you know, my parents are eventually going to die. I'm going to die, hopefully before my wife, but maybe she'll die before me. Who knows? You'll die. One of us is going to die before the other. I'm not going to go in for that suicide pact that you wanted to do. I'm just not. Just not going to do it.
Even with the motorcycles on fire, going off the building and everything I talked about?
That was pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
But seriously, how much do people want to stick around when the world that they know, like even thinking back to Los Angeles, like when I came back to visit you after I'd been gone for a few years, so much had changed.
Yeah.
Like the places that I liked to go weren't there anymore. And there was all these new places and these new people. And I thought to myself, the Los Angeles that I kind of miss is gone. It doesn't exist anymore. I could never go back to that Los Angeles of the 1990s and early 2000s.
No.
Because it just changes. Everything changes.
And that's, we call space-time, it's like some scientific concept, but you're getting to the heart of it, which is that time is a place. And
yes.
Maybe that's why, as you get older, you start feeling more like a stranger in a strange land.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you like it or not, you're trying to make things be like the place that you're from. And the place that you're from is the past.
Yes.
It's where you're from. It's that time period is where you live. And so you get more and more out of touch and there's just nothing you could do about it. And so I think eventually you say, I'm tired of being a stranger here. I've been gradually moving away from where I belong. So yeah, let's put a cap on it.
Yeah.
Boy, that's a great way to end an episode. Well, that's why this is, this is such a rich text and I didn't actually expect to have such an emotional reaction to an Isaac Asimov story.
Me
I was
neither.
Prejudiced against it, I guess, because it's science fiction. And so I just assumed it would conceptually be interesting, but not concepts of the heart like this,
Yeah.
Which it is. It's a really good one.
This story is a good example of why I think it's great that we changed formats and we moved away from HP Podcraft into Strange Studies, because we never would have tackled something like this in that show. It wasn't about that. And I love that we're growing and changing, tying it all in, into something new that is exciting for me.
Yeah. It's I'm so glad that we're reading things like this and I'm excited about what we have ahead of us.
Yes.
Next month, though, we are going to take a curve back into the horror world with this A Night in Lonesome October book. It's illustrated by Gayan Wilson, which we talked about on the comments show. I hope, a lot of people suggested it. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And after something heavy like this, I think I can handle some Draculas and some Wolfmans and some Lovecraftian horror. So we're going to have a fun Halloween season. I hope you all will tune in for that. I want to thank our reader.
James Holloway is a talent. He is amazing. Check out his podcast, Monster Man. And of course, check out his role-playing game stuff that he's done too. We'll have links to those in the show notes. And I also want to thank some patrons.
I do too. And I'm going to start by thanking Zachary Friedman.
I'd like to thank Mike Sharp.
I'd like to thank Caleb Hoffert.
Douglas Scott. Thank you.
Taylor Cornelius. Thank you so much. That's a Planet of the Apes name. It's like two Planet of the Apes names stuck together.
Oh, it is. Taylor Cornelius, I'd like to thank Tommy Lahala.
Joshua Eggleton, thank you.
Thank you, Amanda Vickers.
Peter Lillevold, thank you.
Lastly, I'd like to thank Bernard Froehler.
Thanks for taking this bicentennial journey with us, and we'll be back with more stuff next month. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.